This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Bookshop on the Corner by Jenny Colgan, performed by Lucy Price Lewis.
A message to readers. There is no dedication in this book, because the entire book is dedicated to you, the reader, to all readers, because this book is about reading and books and how these things can change your life, always, I would argue, for the better. It's also about what it feels like to move and start over, something I've done quite a lot in my life, and the effect that where we choose to live has on how we feel. And can falling in love in real life be like falling in love in stories? And also there's some stuff about cheese, because I've just moved somewhere they make lots of cheese and I can't stop eating it. And a dog called Parsley. But it has a lot about books in it, because Nina Redmond, the heroine, dreams of opening a bookshop. So here are some useful tips about where you read, because I want you to be as comfortable as possible. If I have missed out a really obvious one, or you do something completely different, please drop me a line via Facebook or at Jenny Colgan on Twitter, because I am of the old-fashioned conviction that reading is a pleasure to be carefully guarded at all times, and I truly hope you find this book as pleasing to read as I did to write, wherever you do so. Bath. 9:45 p.m. is my chosen wind-down time for a bath, which drives my husband crazy, as he has to sort the thermostat out if it's not the correct temperature, only very slightly cooler than the surface of the sun, and keep the water constantly topped up. It is a true luxury, except I don't like bath oil. It's disgusting, isn't it? It just coats everything. Anyway, not the point. Book in bath. Paperbacks are ideal, obviously, and the worst that can happen is you have to dry it out on the radiator. All my children's handed-down Harry Potters are utterly warped. But I read a lot on my e-reader, and I will let you into a secret. I turn the pages with my nose. You may not have been blessed with a magnificent Scots-Italian Peter Capaldi nose like me, but with a bit of practice you should soon find it's perfectly possible to keep one of your hands in the water and turn the pages at the same time. If there is anyone in your house with a habit of bursting into the bathroom, make sure you lock the door, as in my experience, people do find the sight slightly hilarious. Alternatively, my friend Says uses both hands but wraps her e-reader in a plastic bag. Sensible. Bed. The only problem with bed reading is its brevity. 2 to 3 pages and you're out like a light. If it's been a particularly long day, you may swim in and out a bit before you actually doze off, and then you'll pick up the book the next evening thinking, was there a pink unicorn running through an examination hall whilst I chased after it in my pyjamas in this book? And I will have to say to you, no, there is nothing like that in this book. You were dropping off, and I'm afraid you have to go back a couple of pages. However, I have helpfully given all the characters very different names from one another. There's nothing worse than reading about a Kathy and a Katie late at night, and I don't want to make anyone's life harder than it needs to be. Sunbed. On holiday on a sunbed is supposed to be perfect for reading, and in fact, in my life, I have measured out my sunburn in terms of how brilliant the books I was reading at the time were. Where to hold the book is a problem, though. Hold it up, and your arm gets tired, and you get a big book-shaped tan mark, which I believe in some circles is quite the cool signifier. Read into the sun, and you squint in an unattractive fashion. Sitting cross-legged with it on the towel is not the most flattering of poses. If you're me, I droop somewhat. Lie on your front, and you sweat onto it, and the plastic bits of the sunbed cut into you. The best thing, if you can find one, is one of those terrific old lady sunbeds, with the fabric protecting bits on them that you can pull over your head. Yes, they look totally stupid, but hey, you're reading in comfort and nobody else's, so you still win. Walking down the street. It used to be quite acceptable to walk down the street carrying a book in front of your nose. People would smile indulgently and step out of your way, because they knew what it was like to need to read something so desperately. I once saw a girl hanging on a strap on the London Tube dislocate her wrist, trying to change at bank and finish a suitable boy at the same time. However, These days, everyone holds their stupid smartphone in front of them the entire time, in case somebody likes a dog picture on Facebook and they miss it by 2 seconds. And therefore, simply walking down the street has become far more of an obstacle course, even without holding up a paperback. Proceed with caution. Book group. If you're reading this for a book group, I can only apologise and assume it's 2:15 a.m. the night before the evening. Something about being forced to read a book, I find, makes you feel like you're still at school. And hey, if we wanted to do homework, we'd go and take that evening class we keep promising we'll do when we get the time. Mostly, if you have to read in a rush, it's in case someone says, "Well, what did you think of that ending?" And you have to nod along, desperately hoping it wasn't a trick ending where they reversed everything. I will tell you, this has happened to me. Therefore, let me reassure you. There is no twist ending in this book. Except, I would say that, wouldn't I, if there actually was. Hammock. Once upon a time when I was young, I had a lovely boyfriend who bought me a hammock and hooked it up on my tiny and highly perilous roof terrace, where I spent many happy hours just rocking and reading, eating quavers, and reflecting on my lovely, handsome boyfriend. Then, listener, I married him, and we had a bunch of children and a dog, and moved somewhere where it rains all the time, and I think the hammock is in storage. This, my friends, is apparently what's known as happy ever after. Stolen book time. Ah, the best time. I often turn up 10 minutes early to pick the children up from swimming, or steal a quarter of an hour after I've done the supermarket shop, and sit in the car and grab some time back from the world for me and my book. We deserve it, and it is all the sweeter. Commuting. Commuting reading is great, if you can get the hang of it, because commuting is so regimented. Just watch the glazed looks of people who trace that infinitely complicated, beautiful dance through stations every day. Your brain instantly complies with the order to remove you from all this for exactly the right amount of time. Put your phone away. All that fussy crud can wait till you get into work. This is your reward for having to commute. Travelling. Travelling is not the same as commuting. I am, as you might expect, very much against Wi-Fi coming to cars and aeroplanes, although, of course, it absolutely is. Even so, pre-book a window seat so you can curl up, put your headphones on and something soothing on the in-flight radio, and dive in for several hours. Except for that bit when they're bringing drinks down the aisle, and you think they're going to miss you and you get a bit antsy and can't concentrate. Put the book down at that point and glance at a magazine, pretending to be really casual and utterly unfussed as to whether you get served or not. I have also tried to eat, drink, listen to music, and read in an economy airline seat all at the same time. Don't do this, unless you have plenty of spare cash handy for someone else's dry cleaning bill. Trains are built for reading. I find a good pair of headphones less troublesome than sitting in the quiet carriage and having to police it for noisy idiots. I'm not saying they should get a prison sentence, but I'm not saying they shouldn't, either. In front of the fire. If you haven't got a fire, a candle will do. The one thing I really look forward to as the nights draw in is a big, cosy fire and a good book. The longer, the better. I love a really, really long novel, a large cup of tea, or glass of wine, depending on how close to the weekend we are, or how much I'm in the mood to stretch the definition of what constitutes the weekend, and a bit of peace and quiet. A dog helps, too. Dogs are tremendously good at showing you don't have to check your phone every 2 seconds to have a happy life. Hospital. I have spent a lot of time in hospitals for one reason or another. I worked in one, I had a bunch of children in one, and those children have subsequently spent a bunch of times falling out of trees and breaking limbs, etc., etc. Hospital time doesn't move like other time. It's a hell of a lot slower, for one thing. It doesn't stop at night, and there is always that slight sense of wonder at everything that is going on. For all the real dramas most of us will know, loss and new life, happiness and the deepest mourning, are happening all around. on every floor of a sterile, overheated building. Terror and pain and joy in every clipped professional footstep on highly polished linoleum. I find it hard to read in hospital. It is like being in a great ship pushing through difficult waters, whilst outside are people on land, walking about and carrying on with normal lives, oblivious to the choppy waters being navigated so very close to them. Poetry works well in hospital, I find. Short things, from which you can look up and feel not quite so fragile, not quite so disconnected. For we are all there, or have been, or will be. It is also a very kind place, a place to sit and read quietly to somebody else. This is why I don't feel any moral outrage when people complain about hospital shops selling cakes and ice cream. Hospitals should always have cakes, at the very, very least. Under a shady tree in a sunny park. But of course, Mr. Whippy ice cream, please, not the solid stuff. Misc. Some of my proudest achievements have been figuring out how to read while breastfeeding, use a pillow under the baby's head, drying my hair, I have awful hair, brushing my teeth, I have good teeth, probably because I brush for well over the official time, waiting for roadworks traffic lights to turn from red to green, locked in the bathroom at a very boring wedding, not my own, at soft play, I once read an entire novel on a wet afternoon whilst my kids frolicked in a ball pool. I think we all had the best day ever. Having a pedicure, I never have manis, can't read through 'em. Standing in a queue. In a convertible, tricky. In church, a sin, and one for which I was righteously punished. On business trips where I had to eat alone in restaurants, you're never alone with a book. And all the way back to where this started, for about a million hours in the right-hand back seat of my dad's old green Saab 99. The weight of my youngest brother's curly head fast asleep in my lap, and a fab lolly to accompany me. So do let me know where you read, because every day with a book is slightly better with one than without, and I wish you nothing but the happiest of days. Now, come and meet Nina. Jenny, kiss, kiss, kiss. Chapter 1. The problem with good things that happen is that very often they disguise themselves as awful things. It would be lovely, wouldn't it, whenever you're going through something difficult, if someone could just tap you on the shoulder and say, "Don't worry, it's completely worth it. It seems like absolutely horrible crap now, but I promise it will all come good in the end." And you could say, "Thank you, fairy godmother." You might also say, "Will I also lose that half stone?" And they would say, "But of course, my child." That would be useful, but it isn't how it is, which is why we sometimes plough on too long with things that aren't making us happy, or give up too quickly on something that might yet work itself out. And it is often difficult to tell precisely which is which. A life lived forwards can be a really irritating thing. So Nina thought, at any rate. Nina Redmond, 29, was telling herself not to cry in public. If you have ever tried giving yourself a good talking to, you'll know it doesn't work terribly well. She was at work, for goodness sake. You weren't meant to cry at work. She wondered if anyone else ever did. Then she wondered if maybe everyone did, even Kathy Neeson, with her stiff, too blonde hair and her thin mouth and her spreadsheets, who was right at this moment, standing in a corner, watching the room with folded arms and a grim expression, after delivering to the small team Nina was a member of, a speech filled with jargon about how there were cutbacks all over, and Birmingham couldn't afford to maintain all its libraries, and how austerity was something they just had to get used to. Nina reckoned probably not. Some people just didn't have a tear in them. What Nina didn't know was that Kathy Neeson cried on the way to work, on the way home from work, post 8 o'clock most nights, every time she made someone redundant, every time she was asked to shave another few percent off an already skeleton budget. Every time she was ordered to produce some new quality-relevant paperwork, and every time her boss dumped a load of admin on her at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon on his way to a skiing holiday, of which he took many. Eventually, she ditched the entire thing and went and worked in a National Trust gift shop for a fifth of the salary and half the hours and none of the tears. But this story is not about Kathy Neeson. It was just, Nina thought, trying to squash down the lump in her throat. It was just that they had been such a little library. Children's story time Tuesday and Thursday mornings, early closing Wednesday afternoon. A shabby, old-fashioned building with tatty linoleum floors. A little musty sometimes, it was true. The big, dripping radiators could take a while to get going of a morning, and then would become instantly too warm, with a bit of a fug, particularly off old Charlie Evans, who came in to keep warm and read the Morning Star, cover to cover, very slowly. She wondered where the Charlie Evanses of the world would go now. Kathy Neeson had explained that they were going to compress the library services into the centre of town, where they would become a hub with a multimedia experience zone, and a coffee shop, and an intersensory experience, whatever that was, even though town was at least 2 bus trips too far for most of their elderly or buggied-up clientele. Their lovely, tatty, old, pitched-roof premises were being sold off to become executive apartments that would be well beyond the reach of a librarian's salary. And Nina Redmond, 29, bookworm, with her long tangle of auburn hair, her pale skin with freckles dotted here and there, and a shyness that made her blush, or want to burst into tears, at the most inopportune moments, was, she got the feeling, going to be thrown out into the cold winds of a world that was getting a lot of unemployed librarians on the market at the same time. So, Kathy Neeson had concluded, you can pretty much get started on packing up the books right away. She said books, like it was a word she found distasteful in her shiny new vision of media tech services, all those grubby, awkward books. Nina dragged herself into the back room with a heavy heart and a slight redness around her eyes. Fortunately, everyone else looked more or less the same way. Old Rita O'Leary, who should probably have retired about a decade ago but was so kind to their clientele that everyone overlooked the fact that she couldn't see the numbers on the Dewey Decimal System anymore, and filed more or less at random, had burst into floods, and Nina had been able to cover up her own sadness, comforting her.
"You know who else did this?" hissed her colleague Griffin through his straggly beard as she made her way through.
Griffin was casting a wary look at Kathy Neeson still out in the main area as he spoke.
"The Nazis. They packed up all the books and threw them onto bonfires."
"They're not throwing them onto bonfires," said Nina. "They're not actually Nazis."
"That's what everyone thinks. Then before you know it, you've got Nazis."
With breathtaking speed, there'd been a sale of sorts, with most of their clientele leafing through old familiar favourites in the 10p box, and leaving the shinier, newer stock behind. Now, as the days went on, they were meant to be packing up the rest of the books to ship them to the central library, but Griffin's normally sullen face was looking even darker than usual. He had a long, unpleasantly scrawny beard, and a scornful attitude towards people who didn't read the books he liked. As the only books he liked were obscure 1950s out-of-print stories about frustrated young men who drank too much in Fitzrovia, that gave him a lot of time to hone his attitude. He was still talking about book burners.
"They won't get burned. They'll go to the big place in town."
Nina couldn't bring herself to even say Media Tech. Griffin snorted.
"Have you seen the plans? Coffee, computers, DVDs, plants, admin offices, and people doing cost-benefit analysis and harassing the unemployed. Sorry, running mindfulness workshops. There isn't room for a book in the whole damn place."
He gestured at the dozens of boxes.
"This will be landfill. They'll use it to make roads."
"They won't."
"They will. That's what they do with dead books, didn't you know? Turn them into underlay for roads.
so great big cars can roll over the top of centuries of thought and ideas and scholarship, metaphorically stamping a love of learning into the dust with their stupid big tires and blustering Top Gear idiots killing the planet.
You're not in the best of moods this morning, are you, Griffin? Could you two hurry it along a bit over there? Said Cathy Neeson, bustling in, sounding anxious. They only had the budget for the collection trucks for one afternoon. If they didn't manage to load everything up in time, she'd be in serious trouble.
Yes, Commandant Uberfuhrer, said Griffin under his breath as she bustled out again, her blonde bob still rigid. God, that woman is so evil, it's unbelievable.
But Nina wasn't listening. She was looking instead in despair at the thousands of volumes around her, so hopeful with their beautiful covers and optimistic blurbs. To condemn any of them to the waste disposal seemed heartbreaking. These were books. To Nina, it was like closing down a dog's home, and there was no way they were going to get it all done today, no matter what Cathy Neeson thought. Which was how, 6 hours later, when Nina's mini-metro pulled up in front of the front door of her tiny shared house, it was completely and utterly stuffed with volumes.
"Oh, no,"
said Sarinda, coming to the door and folding her arms over her rather impressive bosom. She had a grim expression on her face. Nina had met her mother, who was a police superintendent. Sarinda had inherited the expression. She used it on Nina quite a lot.
"You're not bringing them in here. Absolutely not. It's just, I mean, they're in perfect condition."
"It's not that," said Sarinda, "and don't give me that look, like I'm turning away orphans."
"Well, in a way," said Nina, trying not to look too pleading.
"The choice of the house won't take it, Nina. I've told you before."
Nina and Sarinda had shared the tiny terraced house very happily for 4 years, ever since Nina had arrived in Edgbaston by way of Chester. They hadn't known each other beforehand, and had thus been in the happy position of being able to become housemate friends, rather than friends who moved in together and then fell out. Nina lived in some worry about Sarinda finding a serious boyfriend and moving out, or moving him in, but despite a large number of suitors, it hadn't happened yet, which was useful. Sarinda would point out that there was no reason to think that she was the only person this might happen to, but Nina's crippling shyness and solitary habit of reading all the time meant they both felt reasonably sure that Sarinda was going to get lucky first. Nina had always been the quiet one, on the sidelines, observing things through the medium of the novels she loved to read. Plus, she thought, after another awkward evening chatting to the clumsy friends of Sarinda's latest paramour, she just hadn't met anyone who compared to the heroes of the books she loved. A Mr. Darcy, or a Heathcliff, or even, in the right mood, a Christian Grey. The nervous, clammy-handed boys to whom she could never think of anything funny or witty to say really couldn't compare. They didn't stride over Yorkshire moors looking swarthy and furious. They didn't refuse to dance with you at the pump room whilst secretly harbouring a deep, lifelong passion for you. They just got drunk at the Christmas party, as Griffin had, and tried to stick their tongue down your throat whilst bleating on for hours about how their relationship with their girlfriend wasn't actually that serious, really. Anyway, Sarinda was looking furious, and worst of all, she was right. When it came to books, there simply wasn't the space. There were books everywhere. Books on the landing, books on the stairs, books filling Nina's room completely, books carefully filed in the sitting room, books in the loo, just in case. Nina always liked to feel that Little Women was close by in a crisis.
"But I can't leave them out in the cold," she pleaded.
"Nina, it's a load of dead wood, some of which smells."
"But..."
Sarinda's expression didn't change as she looked severely at Nina.
"Nina, I'm calling it. This is getting totally out of hand. You're packing up the library all week. It will just get worse and worse."
She stepped forward and grabbed a huge romance Nina adored from the top of the pile.
"Look at this. You already have it." "Yes, I know, but this is the hardback first edition. Look, it's beautiful. I've never been read."
"And it won't be read either, because your reading pile is taller than I am."
The two girls were standing out on the street now, Sarinda so cross she'd piled out of the front door.
"No," said Sarinda, raising her voice. "No. This time I'm absolutely putting my foot down."
Nina felt herself starting to shake. She realized they were on the verge of having a fallout, and she couldn't bear confrontation or any form of argument at all. Sarinda knew this as well.
"Please," she said.
Sarinda threw up her hands.
"God, it's like kicking a puppy. You're not dealing with this job change, are you? You're not dealing with it at all. You just roll over and play dead."
"Also,"
Nina whispered, staring at the pavement as the door swung shut behind them,
"I forgot my keys this morning. I think we're locked out."
Sarinda had stared at her furiously. Then, thank God, after making the police commissioner face, had finally burst out laughing. They had gone down to the corner of their street to a nice little gastro pub, which was normally overrun but tonight wasn't too jammed, and found a cosy corner. Sarinda had bought a bottle of wine, which Nina looked at warily. This was normally a bad sign, the start of the "What's wrong with Nina?" conversation that generally began after the second glass. After all, it was okay, wasn't it, to love books and love your job and live life like that? Nice, cosy, routine. Or it had been.
"No,"
said Sarinda, putting down her second glass with a sigh. Nina composed her face into a long-suffering listening look. Sarinda worked in a jewellery importing office, running the books and the diamond traders. She was great at it. They were all terrified of her. Both her admin and her absenteeism skills were legendary.
"It's not enough, is it, Neens?"
Nina concentrated on her glass, wishing the attention was anywhere else.
"What did the resettlement officer say?"
He said there weren't a lot of jobs left in libraries, not after the cuts. They're going to staff them with volunteers."
Sarinda made a snorting noise. "Those lovely old ladies." Nina nodded.
"But they can't set people up with the right novels. They don't know what a 9-year-old needs to read after Harry Potter. The Knife of Never Letting Go," said Nina automatically.
"That's exactly what I mean. That expertise. Can they work the ordering system, the filing, the back office?" Nina shook her head.
"Not really."
"So where are you meant to go?" Nina shrugged.
"There might be facilitation roles in the new media hub, but I'd have to take a team-building course and reapply."
"A team-building course?"
"Yes."
"You?" Sarinda laughed. "Did you sign up?" Nina shook her head.
"Griffin did."
"Well, you have to." Nina heaved a sigh.
"I suppose so."
"You're losing your job, Nina. You're losing it. Mooning around reading Georgette Heyer all afternoon isn't going to change that, is it?" Nina shook her head.
"Get it together." "If I do, can I bring the books into the house?"
"No."
Chapter 2
Nina turned up to the team-building course nervously. She wasn't sure what to expect at all. Also, she still had a car full of books. Griffin was there, his leg casually placed on his opposite knee, as if he was trying to give the impression of being the most laid-back person of all time. It didn't work terribly well. His ponytail hung lankly down the back of his slightly grey T-shirt, and his glasses were smeared.
"Trainee tossers,"
he whispered to Nina, to make her feel better. She didn't. She felt worse, and fussed with her floral shirt. Outside, spring was tossing itself about like a small boat, one moment drenched, the next bathed in sunlight. Sarinda had been right. It absolutely was time to buck herself up. But sometimes she felt the world wasn't built for people like her. Confident, big personality people like Sarinda simply didn't understand. If you weren't an extrovert, if you weren't shoving yourself out into the open all the time, posting selfies everywhere, demanding attention, talking constantly, people just gazed straight past you. You got overlooked. And normally she didn't mind. But now, Nina could see she was in danger of overlooking herself. However many books she tried to save, whatever she tried to do, the branch library was closing. Her job was going, and it wasn't just a case of finding another one. Librarians were unemployed everywhere. 30 would apply for every job going. It was like being a typewriter repairman or someone who made fax machines. She felt, at 29, oddly surplus to life's requirements. A young man bounded up onto the little dais at the front of the back room of the library, where they'd all gathered, along with the groups from the other two libraries also closing in the region. There was a lot of muttering and complaining when they met, about the bloody government and how crap everything was, and didn't they know what libraries did for their communities? Nina thought they did know. They simply didn't care.
"Hey," said the young man, who was dressed in jeans and a pink open-necked shirt.
"I wonder what he's paid for doing this," whispered Griffin. "More than us, I bet."
Nina blinked. She'd never been in it for the money.
"Hey, everyone," said the young man, who had one of those voices that went up at the end and made everything sound like a question. "Now, I know this isn't an ideal situation."
"You reckon," snorted Griffin.
"But I'm sure we're going to all get on great by the end of the day. Do a bit of bonding, a bit of confidence building, yeah?"
Griffin snorted again, but Nina leaned forward a little. Confidence building? Couldn't hurt. It came an hour into the morning. They were playing trust games to restore faith in something or other, despite the fact that they were all going to have to compete against one another for the few remaining jobs. Nina had walked blindfolded across the room, guided only by the others' voices. And now, here she was standing on a table, again with her eyes shut, waiting to fall backwards. She felt nervous and irritated all at once. This wasn't for her, the shouting, the showing off. Mungo, the young man, had been encouraging, however.
"Don't think there isn't anything you can't do," he'd shouted. "Yeah?"
Griffin had sighed. Nina, though, had looked at him. Could there be something in it after all?
"There's nothing you can't do if you try."
"Oh, good. I think I'll join the Olympic diving squad," Griffin had commented.
Mungo's smile hadn't dropped for a moment. Then he'd lifted his trouser leg, and the room had gasped. Underneath, his leg was smooth plastic.
"I'd still give it a go," he said.
"Come on. What do you really want to do?"
"Run a media tech department," said Griffin quickly.
He was convinced, Nina knew, that Mungo was a corporate spy. Mungo merely nodded.
"Let's go round the room," he said. "Be honest. There are no spies here."
Nina shrank back in her seat. She couldn't bear speaking in public. A gruff man she didn't know spoke up from the back of the room.
"I always wanted to work with animals," he said. "Out in the wild, spotting them, tracking their numbers. You know what I mean?"
"That sounds amazing," said Mungo, and he sounded like he meant it. "Great! Come up to the front."
Nina shriveled inside as they all had to gather around the table, and the man stood up on it and fell back, letting the crowd catch him.
"I always wanted to do make-up for movies," said a young receptionist from Central Services. "Make up the big stars and that."
Mungo nodded, and she came forward and fell too. Nina couldn't believe how casually everyone got into it.
"I just want to work with books," said Rita. "That's all I ever wanted to do."
More ideas came in from around the room, with lots of nodding from everyone and the occasional round of applause. They didn't make Rita do the fall backwards, though, not with her hips. Even Griffin modified his original answer, muttering that actually he'd really wanted to be a comic book artist. Nina didn't speak. She was thinking furiously. Finally, she saw that Mungo was staring at her.
"Yes?"
"Come on, you're last. You have to say what you want to do. And be honest."
Very reluctantly, Nina edged towards the table.
"I haven't really thought about it."
"Course you have," said Mungo. "Everybody has."
"Well, it'll sound silly,
especially these days.
Nothing sounds silly in here, he said. We've all been falling backwards off tables.
Nina climbed up onto the table. The rest of the group looked at her expectantly. Her throat went dry, and her mind went blank.
Well,
she said, feeling herself colour in that awful way. She swallowed painfully.
Well, I mean, well, I always dreamed that one day I might have my own bookshop, just a very little one.
There was silence. And then, around the room,
me too, oh yes, that sounds lovely.
Close your eyes, said Mungo gently. And with that, she leaned backwards, eyes tight shut, and fell into the waiting arms, which held her, then gently returned her to the floor. And by the time she opened her eyes again, she wondered.
A shop? Griffin, of course, pooh-poohed it. A bookshop? Are you nuts?
Nina shrugged.
I don't know, she said. I could sell your comics in it.
She was still feeling oddly inspired. Mungo had taken her aside at the break and they'd discussed it. She'd expressed her inability to deal with overheads or stock or staff or all the huge and paralysing commitments that running a shop would entail that she didn't feel she could deal with. He'd nodded gently. Finally, she'd confessed that she had a whole shop's worth of stock in her car, and he'd laughed and then held up his hand.
You know, he'd said, there are mobile versions of this kind of thing.
What do you mean?
Well, instead of a shop with running costs and so on, you could do something different.
He showed her a picture on a website of a woman who ran a bookshop from a barge. Nina had seen her before and sighed with envy.
It doesn't have to be a barge, he said.
Mungo pulled up a few more sites on his computer. I knew a woman in Cornwall who ran a bakery from a van.
A whole bakery?
A whole bakery. People used to come for miles.
Nina blinked.
A van?
Why not? Can you drive?
Yes.
You could kit it out quite nicely, couldn't you?
Nina didn't tell him that it had taken her forever to learn how to reverse around corners. Mungo's bouncy enthusiasm was so all-encompassing, it somehow felt easier just to agree with him. She showed Griffin an ad in the paper she'd found during the break, helped by an admiring Mungo.
Look at this.
What is that?
It's a van.
A smelly old food van?
A smelly old food van, agreed Nina reluctantly. Okay, that one probably won't work. But look at this one.
You think vans are the answer to everything, grumbled Griffin. They'll have bugs.
I just said no food vans.
Nina's faintly irritated voice caused Griffin to look up from his pint in surprise, as if a mouse had roared.
Be sensible. Look at this.
It's a van, said Griffin with exaggerated sarcasm. I don't know what you expect me to say about it.
I expect you to say, wow, Nina, that's amazing. Imagine you taking charge of your life and thinking of something like that.
Have you gone soft on that Mungo?
No, Griffin, he's a child. But I like his attitude.
I don't get it, said Griffin. A van? Well, I thought you said you wanted to run a bookshop.
I do, said Nina. But I can't afford premises, can I?
No, said Griffin. You're a terrible risk for a bank to lend money to. You don't know anything about running a shop.
I know, said Nina. But I do know about books, don't I?
Griffin looked at her.
Yes, he admitted grudgingly. You're pretty good at books.
And I'd get redundancy money, said Nina. And I could sell the Mini Metro. I mean, I could afford a van, just about. And I've got all the stock from the library, and my life. And everywhere, really. I mean, I could start with that. Pretty much fill it and see where I go from there.
You do have too many books, said Griffin, and I never thought I'd say that about anybody.
Well,
said Nina, if I have the stock, and I have a van.
What?
I mean, I don't see what's stopping me just travelling about selling books.
She was feeling genuinely excited now, something buzzing in her chest. Why not her? Why should everyone else get to have dreams and not her?
What, in Edgbaston?
No, said Nina. It will have to be somewhere without parking restrictions.
Well, I think that's like nowhere.
Somewhere they don't mind. Somewhere I'm allowed to just sell books.
I don't think it works like that.
Well, like a farmer's market, where they turn up once a week to sell stuff.
So you'll work one day a week and spend the rest of the time tending your book crops?
Stop pouring cold water on everything.
I'm not. I'm just being realistic. What kind of a friend would I be if I sat here saying, yes, Nina, drop everything in your life before you even know if you have a job or not. Toss it all away for a pipe dream when you're nearly 30.
Hmm, said Nina, feeling flattened.
I mean, said Griffin, you can't say it's in your nature to take daredevil risks. You've never been late back from a lunch break in the 6 years I've known you. You've never made a staff suggestion, or complained about anything, or stayed out to have an extra cup of coffee during a fire alarm. Nothing. Little Miss Perfect Corporate Person, Little Miss Ultimate Librarian, and now you're going to buy a van and sell books out in the wild? For a job?
Does that sound crazy? Said Nina.
Yes, said Griffin.
Hmm, said Nina. What are you going to do? Are you going to apply to comic shops and illustrators and stuff?
Griffin looked embarrassed for a moment.
Oh, he said. God, no, not really. No. I'll probably just apply for one of the new jobs, you know, for safety, as a knowledge facilitator.
Nina nodded sadly.
Yes, me too.
I'll never get it against you, said Griffin.
Don't be daft. Of course you will, said Nina, glancing down at the paper again, feeling an awkward flush pass through her. She focused on the ad. This van is miles away, probably.
Griffin leaned over her to look at the ad, then shook with laughter.
Nina, you can't have that van.
Why not? That's the one I want.
She modified what she was saying. That's the one I would have wanted. The van was white, boxy, old-fashioned, with big headlamps. It had a door towards the back of one of the sides, with a little set of metal steps that folded out. It looked retro and rather lovely. And best of all, there was plenty of space for shelving inside. A leftover from the bread van it had once been. It was gorgeous.
Well, good luck, said Griffin, pointing at the small print. Look, it's in Scotland.
Chapter 3 Kathy Neeson had everyone in individually to look at core skills development. It wasn't an interview. Of course it wasn't. What it was, truly, was cold-blooded torture. But of course nobody could say that. Nina was quivering with nerves by the time she got into the room. Kathy looked up as if she didn't recognise her, which she didn't, as she had a child with whooping cough whom she'd settled at 3 a.m., which didn't fill Nina with confidence. She glanced quickly at her notes.
"Ah, Nina," she said. "Nice to see you."
She looked again at her paperwork and frowned slightly.
"So you've enjoyed working at the library, yes?"
Nina nodded.
"Yes, very much. But you must be excited by our new direction, no?"
"I found the team-building course really helpful," Nina said. To be honest, she had thought of little else since. Of how the van might look, parked up, inviting and sparkling, and what she might put inside, and how big a collection she would need to have a good chance of stocking the kinds of things people might like, and where she could source other second-hand books when the library had been totally cleared, and... She realised she'd drifted off, and that Kathy Neeson was staring at her intently. Kathy Neeson hated this part of her job so much she wanted to stab it. The idea was to gently dissuade unsuitable candidates from applying and save the interview process some time. But the truth was, Kathy wasn't sure the noisy, apprentice-style kids who seemed to get all the jobs these days were what they really needed. A nice manner and a level head would surely get you much further, but that didn't cut much ice with the big cheeses, who liked flashy mission statements and loud, confident remarks.
"So are you still thinking of applying?"
"Why?" said Nina, a look of panic crossing her face.
"Shouldn't I?"
Kathy Neeson sighed.
"Just have a think about how your core skill set would fit in," she said blandly, "and good luck."
"What the hell does that mean?" thought Nina, stumbling up to go. Nina was still obsessing over the small ads for vans when she ought to have been preparing for the interview, but couldn't find anything even vaguely as nice as this one elsewhere. It just felt right, with its funny little nose and its curved roof. There was nothing for it. She was going to have to go to Scotland. Griffin came up behind her, squinting.
"You cannot be serious," he said.
"I just want to have a look," she protested. "It's just a thought."
"Time's running a bit short for thoughts," said Griffin. Could I ask you something?"
"What?"
said Nina, instantly wary.
"Could you look over this application for me?"
He looked shamefaced.
"Griffin, you know I'm going for the same job."
"Uh-huh, but you're so much better at this stuff than me."
"Well, why wouldn't I totally just tell you all the wrong things to write and make you put in a really terrible application?"
"Because you're too nice to do that."
"Maybe I've just been lulling you into a false sense of security."
"For 4 years?"
"Maybe."
"Nah," said Griffin, with a complacent look that made Nina want to spill her coffee on him. "You're too sweet. Too sweet not to help me, and too sweet to drive a truck."
"You reckon?" said Nina.
"Yup."
He pushed over the forms.
"Could you just take a look at it? Let me know. Come on, they're interviewing us both anyway. Might as well help out your illiterate chum."
Nina looked at him. She knew her session with Kathy had not gone well. It was almost like she was sabotaging herself by helping Griffin. On the other hand, he needed help. With a sigh, she took the application and plunged deep into impenetrable paragraphs about multimedia moving forward and crowdsourcing content. The more she read, the more depressed she felt. Was this what the world wanted now? Because if it was, she didn't know if she had it. She tried to help Griffin with some of his more incomprehensible sentence structures, but she couldn't help comparing all this stuff about paradigms and envelope pushing and sustainability targets with her own application, which had short, neatly typed paragraphs about libraries being the centre of their communities, and how reading helped children fulfil their potential. This had, she could see, much grander ambitions. She sighed and looked at the ad again. The van was long, not unlike an ice cream truck, with an old-fashioned frontage. The pictures of the interior revealed it to be completely empty, with enough space, she'd actually drawn a model of it on some paper, for plenty of high shelving down each side, plus a little corner seating area where she could have a sofa, and maybe the children's books, a couple of bean bags. She found herself staring dreamily out of the open window into the noisy Birmingham evening. Outside, two men were having a loud discussion about how someone had stitched them up about a car. A clutch of adolescents were screaming with laughter on their way down the road. There were four buses honking at the crossroads for some reason, and there was the endless roar of traffic from the nearby flyover. But Nina didn't hear any of it. She could see it perfectly. She could. She could imagine the entire thing. Some petrol, her stock. So many of the books she'd picked up were absolutely brand new, in perfect order. And with all the libraries closing, was it possible she could bring something good out of something so awful? She glanced at the address again. Kirinthief. She looked up ways of getting there. The fast ones weren't cheap, and the cheap ones... She had weeks of holiday entitlement that she'd never taken. If she didn't get a new job, she was going to lose it all anyway, right? She might as well take advantage of some of the last free days she'd ever get paid for. Before she knew it, She'd finished Griffin's grandiose application form and booked herself a coach ticket.
Chapter 4 Nina let her book fall into her lap, conscious that she was getting drowsy. It was late in the evening, and she'd been on the bus all day, with only the shortest of stops to stretch her legs and wander about at motorway service stations, not normally great places to relax. The day was nearly over, but the sun was still high in the sky. It stayed light here far later than it did down in Birmingham, and it was glowing strongly through the left-hand window she was leaning against as they crossed the Forth Road Bridge. The glow off the quiet Firth was shining pink, making it feel, for an instant, as though the bus was flying through the white wires of the great structure. Nina had never been to Scotland before. In fact, as she'd booked her ticket, for less than the price of an evening in the pub, she'd realised that at the age of 29, there were lots of places she'd never been. Of course, she'd been to Narnia, and the Little House on the Prairie, and Wonderland, but to actually smell the deep, rich, yeasty smell of the old grey streets as they'd approached Edinburgh, the ancient cobbles almost making her dismount then and there as the iron sky was reflected in the windows of the tall houses, the oldest skyscrapers on earth, that had made her sit up, entranced by the higgledy-piggledy little streets that wandered here and there, tangling over the great, wide ones, and the austere castle on a cliff that appeared to have been parachuted into the middle of the bustling city. And still they went on, north, ever north, the sky growing even larger as they crossed the great bridge, the iron railway bridge to the right of her, the traffic thinning out as they drove through rolling farmland and harsh, craggy landscapes, and long moors under the wide, clouded sky. There were fewer people on the bus, too. There had been plenty of comings and goings at Newcastle and Berwick and Edinburgh, but now it was only her and a few elderly people, and what looked like oil workers, sitting patiently. Tough-looking men on their own, grunting at each other, their faces set to whatever lay ahead of them. One moment she would look up from her book to see a great brown plane, the golden light playing through the heather. The next she was in time to see an osprey dive across the road towards a lock, which made her start. Then, as they crested the next mountain, a ray of sunshine came out, and she put her book down altogether. Perhaps if it had been rainy that spring weekend, everything would have been very different. Nina would have sat reading, huddled up in her duffel coat. She would have exchanged a few words with the sellers of the van, thanked them politely, gone home to think again. Had the wind been coming off the sea, had the bridge been closed to high-sided traffic because of strong winds, had a million different tiny things happened. Because life is like that, isn't it? If you thought of all the tiny things that divert your path one way or another, some good, some bad, you'd never do anything ever again. And some people don't. Some people go through life not really deciding to do much, not wanting to, always too fearful of the consequences to try something new. Of course, that in itself is also a decision. You'll get somewhere whether you put any effort into it or not, but doing something new is so hard, and a few things can help. That evening, as Nina arrived in Scotland for the very first time, it was not stormy and wet and overcast, with clouds so low they seemed to clip the trees. Instead, it was as if the entire country was showing off for her. The evening was golden, the northern light strange and beautiful. Everywhere she looked, it seemed, were grey stone castles and long, bright vistas, lambs gambling in the fields and deer scattering away in distant woods as the coach rolled past. Two old men who'd got on in Edinburgh started speaking gently to one another in Gaelic, and she tuned her ear in, feeling as she did so that it was not so much talking as singing, and thrilled and astonished that whilst she was technically still in the UK, where she'd spent her entire life, it could still be so strange, so foreign. The road coasted higher, but never seemed to end in the untouched landscape, instead floating above the heathery fields, and Nina found herself urging the bus on and on to where there were no cars and even fewer towns and people. She had a guilty moment when she felt as if she was betraying her beloved Birmingham, with its ring roads and tower blocks and police sirens and jostling pubs and noisy parties and dense traffic. Normally she loved that. Well, she liked it. Well, she tolerated it. But up here, it wasn't hard at all to understand why the Scots thought of themselves as different and apart. She'd travelled in the UK, to London, of course, to Manchester, on holiday in tended, manicured Dorset and Devon. But this was a completely different proposition. A far wilder land unfolding in front of her, so much larger than she'd ever thought of it, had she thought of it at all. Towns and villages appeared at a leisurely rate, with the strangest of names. Ochterdub, Balweary, Donnybristle, all of it unfolding in a strange tongue. It was startling. Just after 9 p.m, but with the sky still light, even though it was only April, the bus finally arrived in Kirinfief. Nina was the only one getting off here, feeling odd and crushed, and so very far from home. She looked around. There were two narrow streets winding down from the side of the hills that surrounded the town, a little pub, a grey-painted restaurant with scrubbed wooden tables, a small grocer's shop, a bakery, a tiny post office, and a shop selling fishing rods. There wasn't a single soul to be seen anywhere. Nobody on the road. Nina felt nervous. In novels, this usually meant that the next person you met was going to try and kill you, and the rest of the community was going to cover it up, or everyone would turn into a werewolf. She told herself not to be ridiculous. Griffin and Sarinda knew where she was. She was going to look at a van. An insurance policy if everything kept going so horribly at work. That was all. This was just business. Normal people did it all the time. She took out her phone regardless and checked it. No signal. She bit her lip, then told herself to get on with it. The pub was called the Rob Roy and was covered in pretty hanging baskets. There was no one sitting outside. The evening had taken on a chill, even though a weak sun was still making its slow way down over the horizon. Nina took a deep breath and pushed open the door. Inside, the old wooden tables were highly polished, and there was a great stone fireplace surrounded by horse brasses and filled with dried flowers. The room was almost empty, but at the bar two old men turned round and regarded her carefully above the pints they were clearly nursing. Nina had to grab her courage with both hands to smile nicely and walk forward. After all, the bus had gone, and there wasn't another until tomorrow, so it wasn't like she had a lot of choice in the matter.
Hello,
she said, conscious suddenly of how English she sounded.
Is the landlord in?
He's just away, isn't it?
Nina couldn't remember feeling more embarrassed in her entire life. A hot flush rose up around her neck. She genuinely hadn't understood a word the man had said. She put her hand to her throat.
Sorry, she said.
It felt like the more she tried to make herself comprehensible, the more she sounded like the Queen. Suddenly, she wished herself very, very far away from here, almost anywhere, in fact. Both men sniggered. Then, thank heavens, the door burst open, and a ruddy-faced man came in carrying a barrel of beer as if it weighed nothing.
"The lass," he said cheerfully. "Hello there. I was wondering if the bus had been through."
"It has,"
she nodded, relieved beyond words. If she concentrated, she could follow him.
Alistair, so what brings you here this time of year? The snow's barely melted off the peakland."
Nina smiled.
"I know. It's beautiful."
His face softened at that.
"Aye, it is. Can I get you a drink?"
Nina didn't recognise any of the beers on tap. She asked for a mineral water, then saw the men shake their heads sadly, and changed her order to half a pint of the local beer, which tasted like fizzy treacle.
"Get some of that down, you lass," Alistair said.
"Are you still doing food?"
asked Nina. They all laughed.
"No, not at this time of night," said Alastair.
He looked up, his eyes very blue under his sandy hair.
"I can probably make you a sandwich if you like."
Nina was starving. The food in the service stations hadn't looked particularly nice and cost a fortune,